are measurable in the lower frequency ranges, in particular microwave spectroscopy. John Hearn will give an engineer's viewpoint of microwave spectroscopy.
I usually tread on the cord at this point. Seems to be no exception today. To be an effective instrument designer in the field of air pollution measurements requires combined skill in chemistry, physics, and electronics. Most of us start out with a basic skill in only one of these areas, and we have to find a way of bridging the gap. After speculating on what the background might be of those of you interested in attending this session, I changed the title of my talk from the original, which was Some Investigations into the Application of Microwave Spectroscopy to Air Pollution Measurements. It seemed a little bit dry to me. To the more personal engineer's view of air pollution measurements and the potential of microwave spectroscopy. This gives me a lot more license about what I talk about, and I'm allowed to make a few personal mistakes without becoming too official about it. I decided, rightly or wrongly, that since WestCon is basically an electronics show, then most of you probably have a predominantly electronics background. Also, social concern rather than professional involvement may have been a factor in attracting you here. In any case, I hope any chemists present will forgive me some of the simplifications that I'm going to have to make to get through this topic. Air pollution measurements are being extensively performed today. Milton Feldstein has given us an excellent account of the typical instruments present in a well-equipped contemporary air pollution control laboratory. Most of the instruments at present in use can show a direct descendance from the original experiments developed by analytical chemists over many years. These were bench experiments, specific reactions performed manually. Analytical chemistry was a common activity long before the word pollution was used to describe the presence of soot and cement dust in the atmosphere. And as we became sensitive to the presence and undesirability of gaseous compounds in the air we breathe, the traditional bench experiments were adapted and automated for use in instruments. Consequence of this is that each compound we measured requires a different design of instrument. In addition, the output of these specific chemical reactants is normally in the form of some kind of chemical change, and the instrument must convert this by optical, conductiometric, or other means to an electrical output. Also, for some instruments, a constant supply of meticulously prepared reagents is necessary. Stability can be a problem, and so can ruggedness. As we've just heard earlier, interferences, distortion of the wanted output signal because of the presence of other compounds at the input, can be a big problem and can lead to further complexity in the wet chemical type of instrument. To an electronic engineer, now here's the personal viewpoint, the best of these instruments looks extremely scary. It looks like a terrifying conglomeration of glass pipes and reagents. But it should be remembered that these are the state of the art. And in the hands of a very professional group of people are yielding the results on which our knowledge of air pollution is based. But the search is on for techniques which will provide the next generation of instruments, hopefully eliminating the shortcomings of present methods and offering the capability of extending the quality and quantity of our air pollution knowledge. First paper this afternoon details some future requirements. And I think these may be summarized for the instrument designer's point of view as follows. First of all, preferably no wet chemistry. Clean, dry, physical methods would reduce maintenance and manpower requirements and increase reliability. It's desirable to reduce the number of different instruments required. Ideally, the ultimate instrument would be electronically tunable to any pollutant. Thirdly, a direct electrical interfacing for both the output data processing and for remote programmability would make things a lot easier, I think, the kind of air pollution monitoring situation that we've been discussing. A faster, more accurate response would enable it to be employed in control systems without difficulty in stabilizing the system, enable it to be used in real-time modeling. Better specificity. As I indicated earlier, some of the classic experiments can be fooled by interfering compounds, especially in the routine instruments, where it is impossible to perform precautionary cross-checks. Of course, the sensitivity must be adequate, and this depends on the application. Extreme sensitivity can be required in the case of ambient monitoring instruments, and As controls are more successful, so even more sensitivity will be required. It's desirable that it should have a capability for extension to other compounds. As we learn more, we shall become more specific in our inquiries. Already we've heard that the classification of hydrocarbons is not sufficiently precise to for all purposes. We'd like to be more specific than that. And if we can adapt our instrument to future as yet unknown requirements, then we'll have an advantage. And the price has to be reasonable too, and this of course depends on the value to the user. A universal instrument would be worth a lot more than an instrument which could measure only one compound. The more specific requirements would be based on the job to be done. For example, in ambient air monitoring, we'd want high sensitivity and high specificity. Stationary source monitoring and control, maybe the smokestack situation, we might have very concentrated gases to be measured. So we don't need too much sensitivity, perhaps, but we would need very high specificity. Automobile testing, here's a more repeatable situation, probably. Concentrations are high, again, because it's a source. Moderate sensitivity is, therefore, the requirement. Medium specificity, because the consistency of the measurement would probably mean that we could make due allowances for a reasonable number of interferences. But also, if it's a production line situation, a pretty fast response is required. For instance, based on the experience I have with my car, I think that if it took 5 minutes to measure the emissions from that car, that would be doubling the production time. I'm sure it didn't take the manufacturer much more than 5 minutes to put it together, judging by the time I've spent finishing it. Investigation and research. Here we want everything. High specificity, high sensitivity, and a flexibility including multiple compound capability. When looking for physical candidates, spectroscopic techniques come high on the list. Lee Langan has given us one example, and I'd like to show you another. Can we have the first slide, please? Ultraviolet and visible spectroscopy depend on changes in electronic energy levels. Infrared spectroscopy exploits vibrational energy changes. The molecule is vibrating, bending, and stretching. In microwave spectroscopy, the molecule is spinning in space, and the energy changes result in a changed speed of rotation. Of course, there's some overlap between these areas, but all the energy changes are governed by the rules of quantum mechanics. Ultraviolet and visible are well-established techniques for which the advantages and disadvantages are well known. Microwave has been somewhat unknown because until recently hardware was not available to make routine spectroscopy possible. Recent developments in solid-state technology make this part of the spectrum potentially much more available than before. A spectrum is obtained in the following way. A gas is placed in the sample cell. The source is a microwave sweeper sweeping between two preset frequencies. And after detection, the recorder displays a plot of amplitude versus frequency. At each frequency for which a photon of microwave energy, the classical H nu, exactly matches the required energy for a jump in rotational energy level of the molecule, a sharp absorption of the microwave signal occurs. That is, the molecule suddenly increases its speed of rotation by the amounts permitted under the laws of quantum mechanics. Here we have an example showing the extremely sharp transitions and the narrow lines at fixed frequencies. This happens to be for sulfur dioxide. And in the case of the next three or four slides, the absorptions are actually recorded upwards from the baseline. For a molecule to have a microwave spectrum, it must have a permanent dipole moment. This asymmetrical distribution of charge within the molecule provides a handle by which the microwave energy can interact with the molecule to make it spin faster. Not all molecules have a permanent dipole moment, but many do. In particular, many highly reactive small molecules characteristic of air pollutants have microwave spectra. The spectrum we are looking at is a common air pollutant, sulfur dioxide. You can see how sharp the lines are. The frequencies of the lines are absolute constants of nature, determined only by the allowed energy change and the moment of inertia of the molecule. So specific is this spectrum to this molecule that if we were to substitute oxygen of atomic weight 18 in place of the normal oxygen 16, we would obtain a totally different spectrum due to the change in moment of inertia of the molecule. So this is different to something you may be more familiar with, mass spectroscopy, where the molecule is broken up and we measure the mass of the individual pieces. Here the molecule is intact, and we have a measurement which is based on the distribution of mass within the molecule. This extraordinary specificity, which enables the technique to unambiguously differentiate between compounds having identical chemical properties, differing only in isotopic composition, is a quality which cannot be matched by any wet chemical technique. It opens up the possibility of pollution source labeling using artificially enriched non-radioactive isotopes. In other words, you can enrich your fuel oil containing sulfur and see whether it's really you that's causing the sulfur dioxide that appears 100 miles away. Now, how does this specificity look when we apply it to the analysis of a mixture of gases? We made up an arbitrary mixture of sulfur dioxide, methyl mercaptan, and ethyl mercaptan. The mercaptans are foul-smelling compounds, often found as air pollutants near paper mills. If you really are electronic engineers, then you may not think you've met mercaptans, but if you're curious enough to want to broaden your experience and don't have a paper mill handy, try surprising a skunk sometime. The characteristic skunk odor is largely due to the presence of mercaptans. Take a look at the SO2 spectrum once more and compare it with the methyl mercaptan recorded over the same frequency interval. You see the spectrum is quite different. Then look at the spectrum of ethyl mercaptan. Different again. It's a very close chemical relative of methyl mercaptan, but quite a different spectrum. Now, if we look at these three compounds altogether, you'll find that the spectrum of the mixture shows virtually no overlap of the individual spectra. Each is easily identified. The analysis of these sulfur-containing compounds is not at all straightforward by traditional wet chemical means because of their chemical similarity. I've got another set of spectra to show you. This time they're taken from an arbitrary mixture of compounds which might occur as a result of auto exhaust. Look at the first one, formaldehyde. In this case, the absorptions are recorded downwards from the baseline. This is due to the National Bureau of Standards getting in on the act between the first set of traces being taken and the second set being taken. I think very reasonably they decided that absorption should be recorded downwards in future, and so we have. Incidentally, in the preprint, I was able to invert the previous traces, so in the preprint all traces are recorded with absorptions downward. This is formaldehyde, also mentioned earlier as one of the components of the photochemical smog mechanism. Acriolin, this is another aldehyde, chemically related, but quite different spectrum. Propionaldehyde. Methanol, this is methyl alcohol. And then if we look at the complete mixture, again we find that the spectra are quite easily resolved, virtually no overlap. Nice narrow lines, nice stable frequencies. We're looking here at a technique which has orders of magnitude more resolution than classical infrared. It's specific to molecules, it's even specific to the particular isotopes of atoms used to make up those molecules. It does not analyze by functional group. It doesn't give you broad classifications. It gives you very specific information about specific molecules. Well, it's at this point that the engineer becomes very excited at the thought of what he could do for his chemist colleagues. And if the technique were only quantitative as well, we'd have a tunable molecular voltmeter. Now, these are terms that I think in. I don't know whether they'd be very acceptable to a chemist. It turns out that contrary to the belief of early workers, the technique is very quantitative. The height or depth, if you like, depending on the age of your records, of the absorption lines in the earlier mixture spectra, do not have a direct relationship to the proportional amounts of the individual compounds present in the mixture due to a power saturation effect. That is, a plot of signal output voltage of the spectrometer versus the input microwave power is not linear. It rolls off rather severely at the higher power levels. Any of these three curves is typical of what happens. You can see as the power is increased, the output signal from a typical spectrometer increases, but not linearly. Eventually reaches a value where it rolls off and starts to fall. These are power saturation curves for small samples of pure ethylene oxide in the sample cell. Obviously, for a pure sample, the total quantity is proportional to the total pressure at a constant temperature. The curves of output signal versus input power are plotted for three sample pressures, 99 microns, 50 microns, and 19 microns. You can very easily see the curvature. For many years, it was thought that it was necessary to operate at the very low power region such that a linear approximation could be used, and then the area between the absorption line and the baseline could be calculated and some measure be obtained of the quantity of gas present. However, this really is a severe requirement, and when you look at the noise and sensitivity performance of a spectrometer under those conditions, it's very marginal. The price paid was too high. However, a recent discovery has been that the maxima of these saturation curves are directly proportional to the pressure of the sample. And this is also recorded on this curve. If you look on the left-hand side and relate the signal in microvolts to the 99 microns, 50 microns, and 19 microns, you find that it's very close to a linear relationship there. And in fact, the quality of the pressure gauge that is used at these low pressures is such that it is not as accurate as the correlation that we have. So the agreement is of the order of 1% or so. The gauge is considerably worse than that. So I don't know what conclusion we're willing to draw on that alone, but maybe we have the basis for another pressure gauge here. But things now are getting exciting. We have a quantitative measurement technique which we can operate at high power now so that we're not wasting the power and sensitivity of the spectrometer. And we have the ability to make accurate measurements using microwave components, things like attenuators, power meters, which are much easier to handle than some of the chemical reactions. The next big question is, does it work in the case of a mixture? This was a pure sample, remember? And the answer is that it does. We look at the next slide. This plot contains the results of several experiments. The dark line shows the linear relationship of maximum signal output versus pressure for a pure sample of ethylene oxide. The horizontal broken lines show what happened when various pure samples were diluted with water, perchlorotoluene, and air. So as I said, there are several examples here. Several different amounts of pure ethylene oxide were put into the sample chamber, obtained points that correspond to the ends of those horizontal lines, the left-hand end of the horizontal line. Then as, for instance, water vapor was leaked into the sample cell, we required more microwave power to saturate, but the signal output level at the point of saturation remained absolutely constant. So total pressure increased due to the total amount of total content of the sample chamber increasing, but the signal due to the ethylene oxide remained constant, and the amount of ethylene oxide remained constant, of course, so the partial pressure remained constant, and we conclude that we have a quantitative method that works for mixtures. Thus, we have a technique which can differentiate between different compounds in a mixture without prior separation of those compounds, or the use of wet chemistry, and by the application of straightforward microwave measurement techniques gives quantitative results potentially in the 1% region. Recent studies have shown that cataloging only two or three lines per spectrum may be necessary to identify a component of a fairly complex mixture, typical of a polluting source. And modern frequency synthesis and phase lock techniques make it easy to generate a series of microwave frequencies and thus to identify quickly the compound of interest. A lot of work has been done in this area by Bill White of NASA and his colleagues, where he has a computer-controlled spectrometer. They've established that basically two or three of these absorption lines are sufficient to give a pretty unambiguous identification of the molecules in a mixture. Well, I hope I've made it seem very simple. I've tried to anyway. The practical spectrometer requires a little more sophistication than I indicated earlier. The source is a little more than a sweeper. It's a synthesizer working between 8 and 40 gigahertz, and it's programmable in 1 kilohertz steps. The absorptions, it turns out, are very weak indeed compared with the background level of the microwave signal. So we normally use two sample cells in series to increase the absorption power. When the samples are subjected to strong electric fields, the absorption lines are displaced in frequency. This is the Stark effect, common in all branches of spectroscopy. By applying electric fields up to 4,000 volts per centimeter in the sample or Stark cell at a 33 kilohertz rate. Sorry, I should have gone on to the next slide. You can see the Stark cell at the top there. By applying 4,000 volts per centimeter at a 33 kilohertz rate to the Stark cell, the absorption lines can be modulated. Then the detector is a synchronous detector operating at the same 33 kilohertz frequency. We get the very sensitive measurements from that. A lot of work remains to be done in the area of sample handling, getting the sample into the spectrometer without modifying it, and then getting it out completely quickly. The complication is that these spectra are obtained under low conditions, low pressure conditions only, but this is compensated for by the reduced possibility of continuing chemical reactions inside the instrument. Also under investigation are simple sample concentrating inlet devices for further improvement in sensitivity, and these will be the subject of a future publication. Well, I hope I've successfully given my fellow engineers an insight into microwave spectroscopy. Maybe a little bit of an insight into some of the physical chemistry problems. Much applications work will have to be done to make it fully useful in air pollution work. I wouldn't want anyone to think that we were further along the road than we really are. But I hope that by bringing the interesting and desirable properties of this form of spectroscopy to the notice of other engineers, we may move closer to its application in solving air pollution problems, particularly in the area of research and investigation. I think we're moving a long way from the era in which dilution was regarded as the solution to pollution. Thank you. The cells we use are each a meter long, so using two of them, we're talking about 6 meters. 2 meters, sorry.
Are there any limitations on the gases you can do in this device?
There are some, but not too many. If the molecule happens not to have a dipole moment, in other words, if its charge is symmetrically distributed, it does not have a microwave spectrum. This means that something like carbon dioxide does not have a spectrum. But the nitrogen oxides, nitrous oxide, nitric, sulfur dioxide, ozone, carbon monoxide, all these aldehydes, many, many compounds do have a microwave spectrum. We haven't seen all these spectra because to obtain some of them, we'd need to go above 40 gigahertz. And this is another region in which we're in a fortunate point in time because microwave technology is on the point of allowing us to go into the higher frequency regions. A side advantage of going higher in frequency is that more, apart from more compounds having spectra, the intensity of the absorptions increases very, very rapidly. excuse me. And we could look forward to more sensitive techniques in the higher frequency range, even for the compounds that we look at now in the lower frequencies.
Could you comment on the sensitivity of the instrument that you have now?
Yes, there isn't a universal sensitivity figure. It varies according to the intensity of the absorption, and this depends on whether you operate at the low frequency or high frequency. But we have done some work with sulfur dioxide. Now, an unmodified instrument, as it stands, can make accurate measurements in this little 1 to 2 parts per million level of sulfur dioxide. A relatively simple sample concentration step can increase that by a factor of 1,000. This puts it, an unmodified instrument, the unmodified technique, in the range of concentrations that you'd expect to find in a source rather than in the ambient air. But our primary enthusiasm for the instrument at the moment is based on its what we think its value should be as an investigative tool.
John, over here.
All right.
Have you put any thought to, or is it practical to consider a remote sensing microwave spectrometer having a, if you will, a radar source or something at a distant point, and looking at the at that distant point for your source, letting the air again, the sort of thing we were doing, yeah. Looking at a light.
Well, it would be very nice if we could. Unfortunately, at full atmospheric pressure, all these beautiful narrow lines become very wide, and in particular, the absorption line due to water in K-band becomes extremely broad, and actually, it really is, the virtues of this technique really do not exist at atmospheric pressure. So we would envisage an instrument which had a calibrated leak into a low-pressure sample chamber. In fact, that's the way we operate it. So.
I noticed in the last HP Journal, there was a discussion of this instrument that you're now talking about. Mm-hmm. I was wondering about the price and availability of this particular instrument, or is that out of place here?
Well, again, it depends on application. But it's that instrument, the full capability research instrument, is not a cheap instrument. It can cost anything from $40,000 to $70,000, depending on the kind of options that you would choose. It's not a thing that you'd install as a monitoring instrument. I would guess that a good monitoring instrument should be probably no more than $5,000 per compound, and ideally should be about $3,000 or less, depending on how easy it is to make the present instrument. I think in terms of a laboratory instrument, it's in a fairly typical price range.
You mentioned that the problem above 40 megahertz or gigahertz is the instrumentation, the synthesizer, I believe. What are the parameters that are lacking above 40 gigahertz?
Oh, there's no particular problem above 40
gigahertz. How high did you say you went, to 60 then?
We go to 40, and up to 40, we can phase lock one of our standard microwave oscillators. This is part of our system. We built the phase lock reference oscillator, which is a synthesizer for the backward wave oscillator. But you must remember that the microwave spectroscopy is not the world's biggest money spinner. And to develop, you know, we can go so far using standard Hewlett Packard type products and putting them together into a spectrometer. To take the step from 40 and above would require that we were the people who are principally interested in making those developments, and that puts a much heavier burden on the spectrometer development budget than it did below 40 gigahertz. But my comment was that solid-state sources, I think, are going to break through the 40 gigahertz region, and we're going to see readily available low-cost oscillators based on solid-state technology, which do not require the complexity of a backward wave oscillator. And then I think we'll be able to move forward again.
Could I remind you to turn in your questionnaires on the way out, please?
I see our audience has decreased slightly in the last 2.5 hours, but For the last speaker on the last day of a session, we always have a slight decrease in the audience. In the past four papers, we've talked primarily about how to measure ambient air pollution data. And the subject of my talk this afternoon is, what do we do with this data once we acquire it? And how do we transform the data into useful information for control purposes? In any control system, we make measurements for a specific purpose. The major purpose is to transform that data into information that is useful to help us describe the state of the system, and then we use this information to control the system. In the early 1960s, a new technique was developed for processing data. The technique involved using mathematical models of the system that was generating the data in conjunction with the data. The use of this new data processing technique was initially made by research organizations and by some of the more sophisticated defense and aerospace industries. In particular, the rocket technology, the aircraft guidance technology, made use of mathematical models of their systems in conjunction with their data. The technology that the name of the name that was given to this technology is now known as modern control theory. And what I'd like to talk about this afternoon is a modern control theory approach to developing a automated regional air pollution control system. My first slide, if you can read it, is basically the subjects that I plan to talk about. First, I'll give you a brief summary of what I intend to talk about. I'll review some of the existing deterministic mathematical models for air pollution modeling. I'll briefly review some of the reasons or some of the failures for these deterministic models to represent real systems. Then I'll describe a modern approach to mathematical modeling of air pollution and describe some of these new techniques that have been used so fruitfully in defense and aerospace industries. Basically, the main reason for the failure of deterministic mathematical models of regional air pollution is they have failed to include the randomness that occurs in the atmosphere. It appears that by using modern control theory, we can enhance the information that's contained in the data from the sensors that we talked about this afternoon. We can enhance that data by using physical models of the atmosphere that is generating this data. Given that we have a validated mathematical model of the air pollution of the regional area, we can then use that model in conjunction with the data to predict faults, and from this information we can develop a control action to be used in real time that will achieve the air quality at minimum cost. In the preprint issue, I discuss some of the more well-known mathematical models of regional air pollution. I've picked three here that seem to be characteristic of the type of mathematical models that have been developed in the past. One well-known model is the model developed by SRI, by Johnson, Lidwick, and Moon. This model was used to was developed for the city of St. Louis and was intended to represent the distribution of carbon monoxide in an urban area. The equation that they use to represent line sources is given by the representation on the slide. It says that the concentration of carbon monoxide is proportional to the source strength times the distance along an axis divided by the wind speed times a parameter that is known as the dispersion parameter. In this equation, there are the parameter sigma 2, which represents the dispersion, is parameterized by five constants. For each different stability class of condition, there is a different set of these parameters, sigma 2. The spatial resolution of this model is 2 square miles. The temporal resolution is 1 hour. And the pollutant that they specifically model was carbon monoxide. This model was used in comparison with real data from St. Louis, and it was shown to give correlation to the trends. In other words, when there was a large buildup of carbon monoxide in a certain area, the mathematical model predicted a large variation, a large buildup in carbon monoxide in this roughly the same area. The second model I'd like to talk about was developed between 1966 and 1967. The working equation for this model is the standard steady-state solution to the mass diffusion equation from a point source. If you integrate this equation with zero initial conditions and a fixed source, you'll wind up with an expression for the dispersion of mass in the form of a cone. This is classically called the Gaussian dispersion cone. In this mathematical model, we have dispersion in three dimensions for a fixed altitude. We have dispersion in the y-axis and the x-axis, where the parameters the dispersion parameters are given by sigma y and sigma z. There are six families of these dispersion parameters, again for the crosswind component and the downwind component, sigma z. This mathematical model had a spatial resolution of 5,000 feet, temporal resolution of 1 hour. It was developed for the state of Connecticut, and it was never validated. The next mathematical model is one that was developed quite recently, and these mathematical models are unsteady state mass dispersion in the planetary boundary layer. The equation is the partial differential equation that was initially used to derive the Gaussian plume equation. This model by Eschenroeder and Martinez is a numerical mathematical model. It solves the partial differential equation numerically for boundary conditions and initial conditions that are assumed known. The parameters in this equation are what is known as the turbulent eddy diffusivities K sub z. These are statistically determined parameters. They're usually parameterized in five families or at least a number of stability classes. In this particular work by Eschenroeder, he had five different levels of discretization in the z-axis or in the vertical axis. He had a variable time resolution, and the model was developed specifically for several pollutants, and it has been verified with Los Angeles data to correlate the trends in CO quite nicely. Now, one of the major problems with the models that are given in the paper is the fact that they are based on deterministic mathematical modeling of a stochastic environment. Part of the stochastic nature of the problem comes from the fact that the wind fields in the area that is being modeled are, first of all, they're not straight streamlines. The boundary layer flow is really in the turbulent domain instead of the laminar domain. We have unsteady state conditions at all times in the boundary layer. The mathematical structure for the diffusion constants is usually not known. And we have no way to include the surface roughness. Aside from all these shortcomings of the mathematical models that presently exist for regional air pollution problem, they're still not being used by air pollution control districts, primarily because, one, they're just in the early stages of development. Generally, the data required to validate a model is not available. In other words, to properly validate a mathematical model, you must know where all the sources of pollutant are and what the concentration distribution is within the region that you're trying to model. And to date, that type of data in a consistent format has not been available in machine-readable format so that mathematical models could be validated. Three, the resolution in these particular models is oftentimes too large to be of useful in a regional air pollution district. And of course, the final reason that they haven't been used is there's lack of confidence because they have been shown to be quite inaccurate when compared with real data. What I'd like to talk about next is how we might go about developing a model that takes into account the shortcomings of the deterministic models, and we'll do this by using the approach that has become almost standard in the defense and aerospace industries. I've called this stochastic modeling, but unfortunately that might be a misnomer for what I'm describing. This is the procedure that we would probably use in developing a mathematical model for any system. We would first pick a mathematical model of the structure of the system. In general, this would require us writing down unsteady state material, energy, and momentum balances for a specific region. The next thing we would do is we would identify parameters in that model. These are the constants in the model that we don't know in advance. In the regional air pollution modeling, the primary parameter that we don't know is how mass disperses in the boundary layer. We would next then gather real data and take this data and compare it with the mathematical model and adjust the parameters in the model to get a verification. One way we might do this is to take the real data and the mathematical model for a fixed set of parameters and integrate the equations and generate the total error that is being accumulated over the time path. And let's say we would take this error and we would square it. So we would have the squared error of the mathematical model versus the data. Then we could do a least squares fit to find the new parameter values. And we would continue this process of iterating back and forth until we had the best possible fit. After we would do this, we would ask the question, is this the best structure that we can come up with? So we would, in procedure number one, we might just take a mass balance. And we would fit the data to a mass balance only. Then we would take an energy balance. And finally, we would go through this iterative procedure until we had come up with a mathematical model that was verified that would have the accuracy needed for the specific purpose that we'd like to use this mathematical model. What I'd like to go through next is a rough outline of how you might go about deriving a mass balance for a regional air pollution area. Let's assume that we had a box, and in this box we have air flowing in. We have a source of pollutant flowing in. The height of the box is given by the height of the boundary layer, and it has a fixed area, arbitrary area on the ground. In order to derive a mathematical model, we would first say, let's assume that we have perfect mixing in the box. This has been shown to be characteristic of high pollution areas, especially during inversion breakups, that we have good mixing. Let's assume for the present that we have no reaction going on in the box and that we have a finite mixing depth, H. Then the material balance for the mass pollutant C is given by this equation where now we take into account the gains and losses of all pollutant species C coming into and going out of this box. So this would be a structure for the mathematical model. And if we would take a number of these boxes and write the same equations for a number of these boxes, we'd find that we have a structure for a mathematical model describing the regional area that could be written down in terms of a vector equation where the vector x represents the concentration of pollutant in each box. The A matrix represents the diffusion type of parameters, and the B matrix represents the how the pollutant sources U are dispersed into the concentration species in each box. Now, normally in a system of derivation of this type, we don't have perfect observations on the species in each box. So we would write another set of equations describing the observations that we actually have, and generally they are fewer than the total number of states that we have in each box. Now, in order to include the fact that, number one, we may have the wrong mathematical model, and number two, that the mathematical model itself contains random forcing terms, we add a random vector to the right-hand side of the equation to come up with our general mathematical structure for the regional area. Now, the next thing we would do is we would try to find what are the values of the parameters that will minimize the error that I'd make with this mathematical model. So I would go out and in a particular box, I would measure a pollutant in a box versus time. And let's say that the jagged line or the continuous line is the measurements that I would make in this box versus time. My objective then would be to find the parameter values in the mathematical model that would minimize an objective function. And let's say, for instance, that it's the squared error criterion that I'm trying to minimize. What I would do then is to pick values of these parameters, calculate the squared error, calculate the gradient of the squared error, and the second partial of the performance with respect to the squared error. And then I would use a gradient procedure or a pure least squares procedure to find the minimum error. The next question is, at what confidence do I have in this mathematical model after I've identified it with real data? Well, there are a number of different ways to verify the mathematical model. Probably the best known procedure is to look at the residuals. You look at the difference between the real data and the predicted data with the mathematical model, and you examine the properties of that function. One of the criterion to have a good fit of data is that I would like to have an unbiased model. In other words, I'd like to calculate the expected value of the residuals over the data length, and I would like to have zero bias. A second property is that I would like to, when I would autocorrelate these residuals, I would find that the autocorrelation function is a Gaussian-White process. In other words, the errors from one sample to the next sample are independent. If these two conditions are met, then I can calculate a confidence level for the model that I've just derived, and I can give it a number. I can say that the model has a confidence level of, say, 95%. In this case, what I'm really doing is doing a chi-squared goodness of fit test with the data. Now that I have a mathematical model of the process, which I have some confidence in, I would like to find a way to make maximum use of the data that's being generated in real time from my remote sensors. So what I would do is take the mathematical model of the air basin and the data, and I would use the two in an estimator to find out what the best estimate of air pollution in the total region is by processing both my data and my mathematical model. At the same time, I would like to be able to predict what my error variance is on the state estimates. I'd like to calculate my statistical confidence intervals on whether or not there is a violation of my ambient quality in a given box. The procedure that I'm talking about in the estimator is to use a common filter to do this. Common filter was developed in 1960 by Rudy Common, At the time he developed, he was working for an aerospace company, Martin Marietta, in Baltimore. And he derived a way to take a mathematical model of a process and real data from a process that contains noise and in real time predict the best estimate of the state of the particular system. This technology was developed in 59. It was first applied in the defense and aerospace systems, and later on it's been applied in the processing industry. It's now used in rolling mills. It's been used in chemical reactors, the basic oxygen furnace. It's used throughout aerospace and military. It's used in nuclear power, the control of nuclear reactors, and it's used in the estimating the voltages and phase angles of large electric power networks. In each of these applications, there has been a validated mathematical model used with real noisy data. The next thing we'd want to do is derive a way to detect when we have an ambient violation. We already have developed an estimator that will give us the best estimate of pollution in the region, and it will give us the error variance of that estimate. Now we would want to use this information to calculate whether or not we have had a fault and what the probability of a fault is in the region. Presently, there are a number of techniques available to do this fault detection. I've listed several in the preprints, but I'd like to point out that these fault detection techniques are presently being used in electric utilities for aircraft engine fault detection and in compressor station fault detection. So the technology is old, it's been proven in other industries, and we might be able to make use of it in the air pollution business. Next, I'd like to talk about how we can use this data in real time, the fault detection system in real time, to develop a policy for control. This is a much harder task than the previous task because here we are seeking to meet the air quality constraints at minimum cost. And the problem, of course, is how do we find cost of pollution? So again, we have data, the model, the estimator, the fault detection system, and now we'd like to find out what is the policy. If a fault has occurred, how do we get the air quality back to its constrained values at minimum cost? Okay, presently, in the paper I've defined a number of ways to do this. Presently, optimal control applications are being made, of course, in the military and aerospace industry. There are some applications beginning to occur in the processing industry, and the water pollution people are doing quite a bit of work in how to minimize the cost of meeting the state water quality standards for an entire river basin. I'd like to summarize by saying, first of all, that the existing models for air pollution modeling have some shortcomings. Possibly some of these shortcomings can be overcome by either one, going through a serious project of validating deterministic models with real data, or by going to a more modern approach of using a much simpler model, but having in the model some random terms and then estimating those random terms with real data. Secondly, we can enhance the information that we're getting from the air sensors by using a mathematical model and the data in an estimator to produce the maximum amount of information from the data. We can then use the state estimator to help us predict faults in the air pollution basin, and eventually we'll go to the implementation of an optimal regulation policy by using the techniques of modern control. I'd invite any questions that you may have.
being from SRI, I feel obligated to at least say a word or two.
Go ahead.
Certain values in the scheme you outline as a diagnostic model, but how do you propose to use this as a prognostic model? You know, there's a delay time between finding out that there is a air pollution problem, being able to shut down industry to be able to affect these controls. For this, we need a prediction of, for example, meteorological conditions on, let's say, a 12, 24-hour basis, which we can then apply as input to the model. How would you then propose to use a model such as yours in a future time state in order to be able to give predictions of pollution conditions in the future?
Well, the model that that I propose is really a lump parameter approach to the partial differential equations describing mass transfer. Therefore, it should be as accurate as a finite difference solution to the nonlinear partial differential equations over a short time period. The parameters that would be identified from the real data, the eddy diffusivities, will be the identical diffusivities that would appear in the partial differential equations.
So in this respect, your model will have some of the very limitations that the current models have, being able to really parameterize the state of the atmosphere in terms of stability and the effect of aerodynamic roughness, etc.
Those will be all those parameters that that are undefinable in terms of numerical experiments on the ground will have to be lumped into this random forcing term on the right-hand side of the equation. So the parameters that that we cannot measure will lump into the right-hand side of the equation, so it will have random errors, as the deterministic models have. But I will be able to quantitatively place an uncertainty on what accuracy I have in my prediction. So when I predict ahead 24 hours what the conditions will be, I'll also predict the variance of my estimate.
Are you actually using a least squares fit to your curve, or are you using some variation of instrumental variables?
Well, actually, we're not using anything. This is thrown out mainly for thought process in terms of what might be done with developing a model. So far as I know, there's only one other person that has proposed this, and it was proposed by John Seinfeld at University of Caltech. In the applications that we've done where we've actually had real data and we've done a job to develop a model, we've used max likelihood techniques.
Of three major assumptions which seem perhaps arbitrary, namely perfect mixing, no chemical dynamics, and third, a finite mixing depth. In the case, for instance, say, of the Los Angeles Basin, which I'm most familiar, I live downwind from Fontana steel mills, and we have visible and chemical evidence that there is not perfect mixing for miles. Mm-hmm. Secondly, there's massive evidence that there is massive chemistry of photochemistry. Thirdly, because of inversion dynamics, the volume, the z dimension, is dynamic in time and space. Which of these assumptions do you think is causing fault detection the most trouble?
The limitations that I've addressed in the derivation of this model can be overcome. For example, you can put in the kinetics of chemical reactions by adding the Arrhenius constant on the right-hand side of the equations. It makes the equations more difficult to handle, and it makes the essentially it produces more uncertainty on the equations. The problem of not perfect mixing is normally handled by putting more boxes putting different levels of boxes on top and still assuming mixing, perfect mixing within a box. And the problem of the variable height, that is included in as a variable that's measured. So it's, as long as you know the height of the inversion layer, the equations still hold. As you have a single box with a slidable lid, and this lid would move up and down, the x and y axis would be constant, but the lid would go up and down, and that appears directly in the equation as a known measurable parameter. And if you don't measure the inversion height, then there's problems with the model.
On a day-to-day, or shall we say episode-to-episode basis, exactly what would a environmental agency administrator be able to do if he had one of these models working compared to if he doesn't have it?
The major use that I see for an online mathematical model by a regional district is to help him assess what the true quality of his air is. The information that he's getting from his sensors is limited to the point concentration at an instant in time at a given location in the area. And as we saw for the Bay Area, there are a number of sensors, point sensors, located throughout the Bay that record minute-by-minute concentrations. How I see a mathematical model being used is to take that data in real time from his sensors that have random errors in them and from an environment that is also random. Because during inversion breakups, we get turbulent eddies that bring around big clumps of mass, especially downwind of power plants. So we may get a very large chunk of mass blowing by this sensor for a few minutes. I see these models being used, whether it be this model or other types of models, I see them being used to help him decide when a fault is occurring. In other words, when there is a violation occurring in his air quality. Okay. Well, this concludes the session 32.